This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Thanks for downloading the Bite Size Business Breakfast podcast from Dubai Eye 103.8. It's the best bits from the Business Breakfast on Wednesday, March the 6th. Coming up, we are crossing live to China. Why? Because the World's People's Congress is going on over in China at the moment. 3-day event where obviously the government set out their visions, their targets. They look at policies, give more details on the moves forward as well. The world is watching, and as are a number of analysts, none more so than Tian Chenzhu, who is the senior economist at China for The Economist Intelligence Unit. He's based out of Beijing, in fact. We were joined by Tian Chen a little earlier on to look at what are some ambitious global and country growth projects and looking in more detail at some of the policies that will feed into that. Vinamra Longani is a long-term friend of the Business Breakfast. Ordinarily, he joins us live from India. Today, he was live in studio. He's the head of business for the India region for SGI Aviation, currently in town meeting clients. Was happy to come into studio to meet Richard Brandy and myself in the flesh and discuss, well, all things aviation. Richard Wayne also joined us this morning. Richard is the CEO of Better Homes. This was an interesting one. Why? Because they've noticed, and we've noticed, that RERA have updated its rent calculator. May mean higher rents, especially for those with legacy rents, or those that have been in properties for a long time as well. What does that mean for the market? Is there any truth in this? Richard was on hand to give us a little insight into that. And Vijay Valleca, the Chief Investment Officer from Century Financial, was also on hand to give us some insight into a couple of other big stories of the day. There were two sort of commodity stories, but at completely different ends of the spectrum. On the one hand, the safe haven of gold hitting record highs. The other hand, the new kid on the block, Bitcoin, hitting record highs. Why are the two hitting record highs at the same time? Is there any connection? Just one of the questions we put to Vijay and other analysts. That's all right here on the Bite Size Business Breakfast podcast.
It's the roller coaster of Bitcoin. Last night, we were celebrating to the sound of this. Bitcoin's back. And Bitcoin was back. And then it wasn't. Went to bed last night, Bitcoin above $69,000. Woke up this morning, $63,000. What's going on? Vijay Valleca is Chief Investment Officer at Century Financial Brokerage here in Dubai. Joins us now live on the line. Morning, Vijay.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm all right, thanks. But how are you? What a 24 hours.
That's always the case with Bitcoin. I mean, it's always been a crazy cryptocurrency.
So what drove it to those record highs last night? And why did it fall off a cliff while we were sleeping?
Well, multiple factors actually are leading the Bitcoin rally. The first factor, of course, we have seen a lot of large whales actually coming and buying Bitcoin this time around. So we actually have, when I say whale, I actually mean anyone who has more than 10,000 Bitcoins in their portfolio or in their wallet. And we have seen almost $670 million worth of buying of Bitcoin in the last 5 days alone of just these whales. Why do we see the volatility? Of course, because anybody who actually got stuck in 2021 at these prices, definitely were waiting for 3 years for an exit. And of course, as soon as they got one, they took their opportunities. And that's why it came down that fast as well.
So where does it go from here? And indeed, is there any way to crunch the numbers and try and predict where it will go from here?
Oh, well, there's, of course, we can definitely have a direction towards where the Bitcoin can head towards. And what actual numbers it will hit is very difficult to predict. Well, we do have the Bitcoin halving coming midway April. So 1 month and 1 week away, we had the Bitcoin halving. Now, Bitcoin halving basically means that the computational capability required to acquire the same amount of Bitcoin will be doubled. Now, this phenomena occurs once every 3 or 4 years. Whenever this occurs, now, of course, there's a rush to get more Bitcoin now because it will cost you half as much now as it will from mid-April onwards. So these kind of things will definitely start the rally much higher. We do expect new highs to be coming on the Bitcoin before the halving actually starts in mid-April. The exact price, of course, is very difficult to say, but somewhere around 80, 82,000 is very, very likely.
Final quick word on gold, also hitting a record high. A lot of the commentary I've read has been about interest rates likely to come down in the United States. Do you buy that investment thesis, and where do you see gold going from here?
Absolutely. I mean, interest rates at these levels, I mean, we have seen inflation and it's actually affecting all of our lives on a day-to-day basis. We actually do expect interest rates to come down, if not much this year, but definitely next year. And if gold is sustaining these levels at a multi-decade high interest rates, once the interest rates do come down, we expect gold prices to actually shoot up much, much further. I mean, when you think of it, gold was trading at around $1,900 an ounce, around 230 dirhams a gram back in 2011. A combined inflation aggregate of 50% in the last 12, 13 years just takes the price of almost all the way till $2,550 or $2,600 an ounce. So yes, we expect the gold rally to continue much further. This will be one of the best asset classes to invest in this year.
Vijay, appreciate your time this morning. Thanks very much indeed.
Dubai Eye 103.8 presents an array of independent expert opinions and does not advise one particular view. Always seek independent legal advice which considers your own personal circumstances.
So what does this mean for gold in particular? Another useless, worthless asset driven solely by consumer sentiment with no value at all to mankind. I would argue, as would Warren Buffett. Others take a different view. So it is at a record high, was there yesterday. I spoke last night just chatting on WhatsApp with Chandu Saroya, who we speak to quite a lot. He has his own jewellery business here in Dubai, and he's also a senior figure within the Dubai Gold and Jewellery Council. So I said to him, what impact is this having in the gold souk? Does it mean that everyone's rushing to sell their bangles, cash in at high prices, and everyone's too scared to buy? This is what he said. He said the price at a record has still not impacted jewellery sales in a big way. We have to wait and watch. If there is a downward correction and the prices stabilise, then we're going to see regular demand. As this is full season time and we were expecting good Ramadan sales, he says if the gold price continues to rise further, then customers will pause and maybe demand will be a little bit less for the next few days until the price becomes the norm. For consumers cashing in their old purchases, so selling your bangles, smelting them down and taking the money, so it's going to take some more time for that to happen. So steady as she goes down at the gold souk.
We've seen ads though in the UK before when prices for gold have risen, literally saying to people, go through the spare drawer, see if you can find a couple of mismatched earrings, we'll buy them off you.
And it does happen, and it will be happening now, but it's a trickle rather than a flood at the moment. Thomas.
The only thing you could say about gold is that it's a little bit more... So, the volatility that you're seeing in the cryptocurrency peaks and troughs are not what we're seeing in gold. It's been a bit of a sort of gradual rally, if you like, 16-month rally, if you like. It's gone up 30% from just above 1,600 per troy ounce in late 2022, all the way to, what was it yesterday, 2,141 per troy ounce yesterday. So it's been gradual, and a lot of that hasn't just been down to people pulling their teeth out and selling them. It's also been down to the central banks. And the fact that central banks have turned around, especially towards the end of last year, and cashed in or weighed in heavily onto gold tells you something. Now, is that them looking to sort of just avert some of the major concern of inflation and the economy and downturns and recession? Or is that them trying to sort of bolster their... I mean, the banks represent fiat currencies, don't they? They need to back those up. So were they seeing a risk from cryptos and blockchain? I don't know. Go figure. It just seems weird that you've got like one of the oldest commodities against one of the newest. You okay me calling crypto a commodity or not?
It's a commodity.
And they're sort of doing the same thing at the same time. It doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't make any sense. Front page of the Financial Times this morning. It's an odd FT headline. Bitcoin and gold hit highs as investors run after risk and safety at the same time. That's got me scratching my head. How do you do that?
Well, yes, but also no. Because wouldn't you just call that a balanced portfolio?
Possibly so.
That's what people tell you to do. I mean, not on a 50-50 sort of split, but yeah, don't put all your eggs in one crypto wallet, etc.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
All right, we're talking to a man this morning about a rental index. Richard Wayne, CEO of Better Homes, and his number crunchers have been watching the RERA rental calculator, and they say that they've noticed something. Richard, good morning.
Good morning, Brandy. Thanks for having me.
What's going on?
Well, I got a call on Monday morning from our property management team who told me that the RERA rent calculator had been updated. And it's something we'd been waiting for a little while. It hadn't been updated for nearly 2 years. And that's going to have a bit of an impact into people's renewals this year.
Right. And we have reached out to RERA. Tell me, how long is it since they were last updated and what would be normal?
It's nearly 2 years. And that is pretty normal. It's normally between 1 and 2 years that they update it.
Okay. And so what kind of change have we seen? Can you give me some examples?
Yeah, exactly. So the general trend is upwards. So the renewal rates that people will now see if they put their own property in there are further in line or more in line with rents that you'll see in the market today. So for a lot of tenants, that will mean that their renewals are going up. To give some examples, we don't have sort of a broad percentage across the board. Every area will be slightly different. But you know, if I take my own personal view, I am both a tenant and a landlord here in Dubai. So I looked at my own house where I rent in Jumeirah. Previously to the change, I was expecting a 5% increase in my rent this year. That's now gone up to 20%, which is, that's put a big smile on my wife's face. Conversely, in my property that I rent out, where I'm a landlord, previously it said there was no rent increase due. Now I can increase that by 10%. So, you know, from a landlord and a tenant point of view, it's a bit of a win and a blow. But all of the, in many cases, the rents are going up.
Let's break down that in a moment. But first, in your opinion, did this need to happen?
Yes. Yeah, and I think in the short answer is yes. I think what we were beginning to see was a sort of a two-tier rental system, those that had moved into properties 2 or 3 years ago, like we did, versus those that were coming into the market today. And there was a big disparity between the prices.
Okay. So what will it mean roughly for tenants?
So if you're a tenant today and you've been in the property for more than 2 or 3 years, you're likely to see a bigger increase in your renewal rates this year. If you're a tenant that's been in a property over the last year or so, you probably won't see anything because the rental calculator will be in line with what you're currently paying. So what will that mean? Well, does that mean that some tenants will decide to take the plunge and move into buying a property? Will it mean that some tenants will decide to move to a slightly cheaper property? So those are the two trends that we might expect off the back of it.
Could we see less eviction notices if landlords can legally get higher rents from current tenants?
Yeah, I think that's an obvious thing to consider. I don't think there is a huge number of landlords today trying to illegally evict tenants and put their rents up. There's quite a lot of protection around that. So it's not something I think we see a huge amount of. But yes, I think it's possibly something we could see.
Okay, well then let me put that another way. Could we see landlords deciding not to move in themselves or indeed not putting a house on the market if they can get better rent?
Yeah, I think if a landlord is making the decision, do I sell the property today and maximise the value versus put my rent up, I think that will give them more of a decision to make or take.
Okay. And for landlords themselves, what does it mean for yields?
I think for landlords who have tenants in there for the last couple of years, it certainly means improved yields going forward. So, you know, I think those that are looking to buy a property today, anyone buying a property today, it's not going to make a huge difference because they will be renting out at today's prices. This is really affecting historical rental prices, people that have been in property for 2 or 3 years.
Do you think then we will see some downsizing on the back of this?
Yeah, now this is where I think we might see a bit of a knock-on effect. It's likely that for some people in properties today, with rents going up, it might make them look to move, might make them look to downsize. Now, the effect of that, that movement in the market, could be actually quite healthy for everybody.
How so?
Because what we've seen, Brandy, is we've got a lot of what we call sitting tenants, sat in properties on lower rents, where they've been for a number of years, who in any normal time might have moved house during that period of time. That lack of movement is creating a bit of a bottleneck, and it's stopping stock coming to the market. So some extra movement in the market, people downsizing, people actually moving, will create more availability, it will make more stock coming to the market, which actually, conversely, might bring rental prices down a little bit.
What are your guys seeing on the rental front when it comes to the number of viewings that they're doing for an apartment at the moment?
Well, look, rents in some key areas we know went up about 25-26% last year, and in some of the most popular villa areas, you know, rents, properties are going before they even hit the market. So if we know a really, really hot property is coming to the market, it'll be, we'll have a queue for it, it'll be one viewing, and we'll get the property rented.
I've heard, though, of 50 viewings for rental apartments where landlords are obviously, well, I'm guessing, looking to get the highest rent. Are we seeing an increase in the average number of people who are going after each property when we're talking renting?
In terms of?
The amount of, I don't know, people you would get calling one of your agents to rent a property.
Yeah, certainly. Certainly the rental market's incredibly hot at the moment. There's lots of people moving to Dubai. So the number of renters per available properties is on the up. It's probably double from what it was 2 years ago. That's why I say, you know, if we get more stock to the market, a little bit more flow, a little bit more movement, transiency in the market, it might actually just be a good thing.
What about when the buildings that we're seeing being built at the moment get handed over? What's that going to look like, and when do you expect that to start kicking in?
So look, the rent's high at the moment. The only real answer to that over the long term is more properties. Okay, so we're expecting about 35,000 homes to be handed over this year. That's very similar to the number of homes we saw last year. Last year, we saw rents go up by 25%. So it stands to reason that there's not enough coming on the market this year to materially impact that in a positive way to bring rents down. If you look ahead maybe into 26, 27, that's where you start to see some quite substantial numbers of new properties coming to the market, where I do expect that will impact rents.
A lot of those new properties, though, particularly if we're talking villas, are further and further mm-hmm. out of town. Is there a rental premium on being central here in Dubai at the moment?
Yeah, absolutely. But that's the same for any major city in the world, isn't it? So anything that's more central, anything that's more coastal, certainly will have a premium. As Dubai spreads, you'll find more and more affordable rental further out. But again, I think that's, you know, that's just the normal maturity of a city.
But what we think of as central is changing, and what we think of as a long commute or a long drive is changing. Are the prices changing with that?
Yes, I guess so. I mean, I remember Springs being launched, and that was considered a long way out, whereas Springs now is considered a very central part of the city. But, you know, obviously, the further out people have to travel, take into account today's traffic as well, I guess, then they can find greater value the further they go.
Okay, so what are you predicting to happen for rents this year before we let you go, Richard?
I think I'm not predicting any major shift in the trajectory of travel that we saw last year. So I think rents will continue to rise a bit this year, although not at the same speed that we saw last year. So, you know, if you always make me put a number on it, but I think we'll see rental rises somewhere around 10% this year.
Richard Wayne, CEO of Better Homes, talking to us this morning about what's happening with rent prices and what's happening with the RERA rental calculator. We appreciate your time.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Size Business Breakfast,
where we are very excited to be talking aviation.
Come fly with me, let's float down to Peru. In Llama Land, there's a one-man band, and he'll toot his flute for you. Come on.
We're talking aviation because joining us in the studio now is one of our favourite aviation analysts, Head of Business for India at SGI Aviation, Vinam Rolongani. Good morning. Good to see you.
It feels surreal to be in the studio with all of you all. So, yes, I'm ecstatic to be here. Thank you for having me again.
We're genuinely excited to have you here. The backstory is, if you're new to the Business Breakfast, we've been speaking to Vinamra for years and years and years, based out of his office in Delhi, particularly during the pandemic, when aviation was, of course, facing many, many challenges. Finally, we get to meet you face to face here in Dubai. So good to have you here. We'll get on to the reason for your visit. You're here for a big aviation event that's happening at the moment. But first of all, we're going to run through some of the big aviation stories and get your take of them over the next 20 minutes or so. And I have to start with the big one that broke over the weekend here in the UAE. Bloomberg reporting unconfirmed suggestions that Etihad Airways is looking for an IPO, a stock market listing. What was your reaction when you read this?
Well, I'm not surprised in the sense that they're not the first Gulf airline to consider an IPO. Flynas in the past has sort of looked at it, or at least there were reports that they were allegedly looking at it. So was the case with Emirates at one point in time, but nothing came to fruition. So neither of them happened. And well, with Etihad, they've gone through this massive transformation. They've sort of cut back on routes, you know, realigned fleets, and now they're very profitable. So I see no reason why they shouldn't consider it. But will it happen or will it not happen is something that we'll just have to wait and see.
Of course, we do have one listed aviation company here in the UAE. We got Air Arabia. It's been listed pretty much since its inception 15 years ago, and that's trading perfectly well, isn't
it,
Brandy?
Are we expecting Flynas as well, I think? Potentially.
Yeah, Vanamra says Flynas is on the block. So there's a few. But to get one of the intercontinental airlines, that would be significant. These are relatively small regional carriers. But to get an Emirates or an Etihad or a Qatar would be, I think, a different ballgame, would it or not?
I don't know. How would it change decision-making at an airline, Vanamra? What generally happens when an airline goes public?
Well, you see, that's the big question. These airlines are currently owned by the government, run by the government, and they are sort of like flag bearers for their respective emirates. So you see, when you see Qatar Airways, of course, it takes you to Doha, it brings you back, brings in business, brings in tourists, and so on and so forth. But then would the owners, would the sovereign government want shareholders, you know, I mean, of course, it depends on the quantum of shares that are sold and listed on the stock market. But would they want somebody else to have a say in how the airline is run? And more importantly, they would then have to sort of, you know, ensure that there's transparency in decision making and so on and so forth. And they've got to then justify the decisions they are taking, the direction the airline goes towards to the public. So I guess that's a call that needs to be taken. But then, like you said, if an airline like Etihad was to go down that route, it cements, in my opinion, their business model, the model that, you know, you are a global connector from this part of the world, and that, you know, and that it's a successful model and one which people would buy into, not just, well, buy tickets to fly on, but also literally buy into as shareholders.
Let me play devil's advocate and give the investment thesis against investing in one of the big intercontinental Gulf carriers like Etihad or Riyadh Air, which we're going to have very shortly. Tony Douglas left Etihad to set up Riyadh Air. And that is that the era of these Gulf hub airlines, perhaps we're in the golden age at the moment. But one of the mega trends you look at is that people want non-stop connectivity when they're flying from Asia to Europe or to North America. They don't want to stop off in Doha or Abu Dhabi or Istanbul or Dubai or wherever it may be. And therefore, maybe now is not the time to buy shares of an Etihad. I'm not saying that's my belief, but that is a thesis that's out there.
Well, I get there's two sides to each coin, I guess. You see, non-stop connectivity is great, provided, you know, it is available at a certain price point. And often what happens is non-stop flights after a certain point price themselves out compared to, you know, one-stop connectivity. I mean, I'll give you an example for Emirates, for instance, okay? So from India, if you want to fly to Dubai, there are, depending on what flight you're on, the fare from India to Dubai might price themselves out on that segment purely because they might want to fill up a plane to Seattle from here or New York or wherever. So again, non-stop connectivity to Dubai in that case on Emirates suffers because they've got to keep that seat for someone traveling beyond. However, from Asia to Europe or the US for that matter, again, if the price is right, you would want to fly non-stop.
What does the longer haul non-stop flights that are on the agenda at the moment, Operation Sunrise, for example, coming out of Qantas, what does that mean for carriers like Emirates and Etihad competition-wise?
Well, I guess, you see, if the market continues to grow, which it of course continues to, there's going to be ample people who'd want to fly. The question really is, for these ultra long haul non-stop flights, you need people to pay top dollar and fill up the front end of the cabin just because you're burning so much more fuel to ensure they fly non-stop. So in that regard, and of course, then there's demand and supply that comes into play. If their flights are emptier than the other, you may get a deal. But largely, you've got to have enough premium passengers paying fully flexible first and business class fares to be able to make these ultra long haul flights profitable, or for them to break even. So there will always be demand for one stop connectivity, but in my opinion, non stop connectivity will be preferred.
My wife's in Tokyo next month for a holiday, mm-hmm. and then he's going straight to Milan for a work meeting. Mm-hmm. So she's like, "Oh, I'll just fly direct."
Yeah.
What's the flight that comes up when you try and book Tokyo to Milan? Emirates via Dubai. So yeah. She's got a 6-hour layover in Dubai. She lives here. Yeah.
The other devil's advocate question when it comes to buying into an airline, and I speak as someone who technically owns stocks in an airline, I've got IAG. Mm. The wafer thin margins that we hear about mm-hmm. for airlines all the time. Someone from a regional carrier once saying to me at one point, when fares were low, that they were literally operating on a takeaway cup of coffee per passenger in economy for margins. How is that attractive to investors? What am I missing?
Well, that's the thing, you see. I mean, at SGI, we do a vast majority of our work for financiers and lessors of aircraft, and we also do some work for the airlines. Now, if you see, in the grand scheme of things, the way aviation stacked up, it's the airlines who actually bring in the revenue from passengers and so on and so forth. And they are the ones who tend to make the least amount of money. Whereas everybody else in the food chain, be it, you know, the person financing the aircraft, leasing the aircraft and so on and so forth, everybody else makes top dollar, or at least that's what the impression is. So yes, I sort of agree with you in that regard when you say that, you know, given the margins, and there are parts of the world where the margins are really low. I mean, when you look at India, for instance, despite being the third largest domestic aviation market, most of our airlines continue to lose money.
Hold that thought, Vinamra. Stay with us. Lots of questions to come. I suspect if Adil Ali was here at Air Arabia, he'd tell you about his healthy profit margins. Maybe we'll get him on the line tomorrow. But for now, more from Vinamra Longani when we come back, including the renaissance, the rebirth, the phoenix from the ashes that is Air India.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast,
where we continue our conversation on flying and we continue our tributes to Frank Sinatra.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. Let me see what's...
And they are in honour of our guest this morning, who is Vinamra Longani, aviation consultant. He is, to give him his full job title, Head of Business for India at SGI Aviation. Long-time commentator on aviation for the Business Breakfast via Teams and Zoom from New Delhi, and for the first time in the Dubai Eye studio. Vinamra, good to have you with us. Thanks for sticking around.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Can we talk about the rise of an airline in your backyard in India? This is, of course, Air India, taken over by the Tatars mm-hmm. and now looking to establish itself on the world stage. This is Campbell Wilson, mm-hmm. someone I'm sure you know well. He's the boss of Air India. Mm-hmm. He was the guy parachuted in, the Australian guy, by the Tatars to sort things out. This is what he had to say, speaking recently to the guys at Bloomberg.
We're trying to transform Air India from, frankly, what was a laggard in terms of product and experience to a peer of the world's best, and massively scale to go from a 100 aircraft airline less than 2 years ago to a 300 aircraft airline in about a year's time.
So many changes that he's putting in place at the moment, my favourite of which happened last week, and that is the new safety video on Air India, which is inspired by dances from various parts of India. Have a listen.
There are 8 emergency exits on this aircraft. Please locate the one closest to you. Note that the nearest exit may be behind you.
Is it going to work, Vinamra?
It's fantastic. And it's gone viral. So a friend of mine was in Singapore and he'd gone to a salon in Singapore. And as soon as he sat down, well, he's Indian. So this very excited lady came up to him and said, "Oh, are you from India?" And he said, "Yes, of course, I'm from India." She was like, "Have you seen this new Air India video? It's so cool. And, you know, these women look so pretty. And I've never paid attention, so much attention ever to a safety video in my life." And then, I mean, I happen to know lots of people at Air India. And they've, of course, done a fantastic job. You see, in my opinion, for an airline that has India in its name, the right thing to do would be to celebrate India, to sell India, to showcase India. And that's exactly what they've done. And, you know, there are, and India's changing. But, for someone my age, okay, we learned about these dance forms in school. But over the years, we're changing. We're becoming more Western by the day. And there's nothing wrong with that, because as you progress, you align yourself to global standards and practices, and there's business, etc. But it's just so nice for me too, personally, to see this showcase of our traditions and our dance forms. And they've done a phenomenal job.
And yet, tensions between India and the Gulf when it comes to aviation, mm-hmm. because we don't have open skies. Mm-hmm. In the chair where you are now, a couple of weeks ago, was Gaith Al-Gaith, the chief executive of Fly Dubai. Record mm-hmm. profits for them, happy days, well done, Mabrouk Gaith. But one of the things he said is, we want to double over the next 5 years.
Yeah.
If we had open skies to India, we could do that. Have a listen to what Gaith had to say to us about India.
Mm-hmm. Or India, let's not go there, have an open sky with us. We will probably go to 20 destinations more in India.
Why is India being so protectionist against the Gulf carriers, we would say, as mm-hmm. people based in the Gulf?
Well, you see, the way the bilateral air transport agreements are set up, well, or have been set up in the past, you know, there's of course. So, for instance, India has open skies with the US. You can mount as much capacity, as many flights between the US and India, then it's not really a problem. Now, with the Gulf Airlines, the bilateral is limited by seats. So each emirate, interestingly, gets a cap of seats, and then that's distributed within their airline. So, for instance, the Dubai cap is split between Fly Dubai and Emirates. And that hasn't gone up for a considerable amount of time. Now, the issue really at hand is, and this is more a perception problem, because I was at the airline economics conference last week in Delhi, and somebody brought this up and said, "Oh, well, you know, there's this huge threat from the Gulf Airlines." Now, if you know a little bit about the way bilaterals are structured, Dubai-based airlines haven't been able to add any capacity over the last couple of years because that bilateral has been maxed out from both sides, right? So in my opinion, enhancing that bilateral would be great for both parties. Now, I don't see an open sky situation happening, but if you add seats to that, Indian Airlines, for instance, I can tell you for a fact, it was in the media that Akasa would like to fly to Dubai. You know, just by virtue of what Dubai has built here, you know, it's a huge tourist destination for people in India. You know, I mean, for a lot of people, it feels like a home away from home because it's close by and there's lots of Indians here, and it's still like it's a great place to come to. So if it was to be relaxed and a certain set of seats were to be allocated, additional seats, I think it's only going to do good to both sides. However, will that happen? I mean, in my opinion, when the free trade agreement was signed between the two countries, like the UAE and India are huge trading partners, I thought that, you know, that was the point where, you know, additional seats will be added to the bilateral, but that hasn't happened.
Final quick word on aircraft. Mm-hmm. You're off to Toulouse after this, to the Airbus factory. At the moment, commercial aircraft is basically a duopoly, Boeing and Airbus. But Boeing facing challenges. Tim Clark recently said Boeing's in the last chance saloon when it comes to problems with delivering the aircraft and, of course, safety issues. Gaith mm-hmm. Al-Gaith, though, was more charitable towards Boeing when he was in the studio. Have a listen to what Gaith had to say.
Boeing, probably the greatest aviation in this company ever created. Yes, they are going through challenges, and they have to live up to that theme. I am personally, as Gaith, confident that Boeing will get it right.
My last question to you, Vinamra, is mm-hmm. about the future of aviation. Is the Boeing-Airbus duopoly going to be broken soon? You were at the Singapore Air Show mm-hmm. a couple of weeks ago. You said the star of the show was a Chinese aircraft.
Well, it was because, and you have to look at it in perspective, because If you were an airline today and you want to start operations and you want to order 100 aircraft, the earliest narrow-body slot, and this is again something which is publicly available, that Airbus can give you for delivery is 2031, 32 probably. I mean, if you're looking at the 220, maybe 2026, 27, perhaps. If you want to get the MAX, well, they have quality issues and they were supposed to ramp up production, and that's not happening because of the issues discussed. So there is, of course, now this new airliner, which the Chinese government is pushing, rightfully so. So much so that they would even be happy to finance it. For airlines, for instance, to just make sure that, you know, it gets going. But before we get to that point, COMAC needs to be certified by EASA, certified by FAA, and so on and so forth.
COMAC is the name of the Chinese brand, isn't it?
That's right, yes.
Would you fly on one?
I perhaps would. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, while we look at it as a Chinese aircraft, the avionics and the engines are still provided by Western entities. So, you know, they haven't got to the point where everything's in-house. I mean, all of us in our studio, wherever, there's a lot of made in China stuff. I mean, like my phone probably is made in China. Perhaps yours is too. So when we use all these utilities day in and day out, I see no reason why we wouldn't fly a Chinese airliner.
Vinamra, great to see you. Appreciate you joining us live in the studio. Enjoy your time in Dubai. Don't be a stranger. The thoughts of Vinamra Longardi, Head of Business at India for the consultancy SGI Aviation.
This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Off to China now. China setting an ambitious growth target of around about 5% for this year, outlining a series of measures aimed at boosting the slightly flagging economy at the moment. The Premier, Li Qiang, making the announcement at the opening of the annual National People's Congress early yesterday morning. It won't come in without its challenges. Let's get some analysis on this now with the senior economist in China for the Economist Intelligence Unit. Joining us live from Beijing is Tianxian Zhu. Tianxian, thank you for your time. What's your take on this ambitious growth target?
Hi, Tom. Yeah, so the growth target of around 5% is I would say that's unsurprising because China has a vision to double its economy in the 15 years from 2021 to 2035. And a reasonable growth level is, let's say, it's needed for that purpose. And policy thinking also goes that propping up growth will help address other problems in the economy, such as unemployment and some social discontent. Yeah, but I agree with you that 5% will be quite an ambitious target to achieve, given that in 2024, the pent-up demand, which has been an important driver in 2023, will have faded this year. And there are also challenges surrounding, for example, the local government debt and the housing sector. Yeah, so I would say that 5% is not among the low-hanging fruits and will probably require some extra government efforts to really achieve that growth.
So to that end, what can the government, what can Beijing do in the next 9 months?
Yeah, so at a time when we can't really identify a particularly strong area of growth, this will be primarily done through fiscal expansion. It is well known that China's local governments are debt-laden, but the central government runs a very low level of debt or leverage. So for that purpose, China's prime minister announced that China will be issuing RMB 1 trillion of ultra-long-term special treasury bonds to support strategic priorities in 2024. And he also hints at similar plans beyond 2024. Yeah, so that would be, let's say, 1 trillion every year from 2024 beyond. And that's equivalent roughly to around 0.8% of GDP. So that would be an extra boost. Yeah, and China will be also introducing some other fiscal or quasi-fiscal stimulus to work towards the 5% GDP target.
Yeah, the National People's Congress ongoing at the moment. We've focused a lot on the fiscal policies and potential policies. I mean, are there policy priorities in general for the government at the Congress?
Yeah, so beyond those economic targets, there are also a list of policy priorities. So this year, the biggest difference versus 2023, we noted, is that industrial and technology advancement is further prioritized in the government's report, suggesting that the government will be adhering to supply-side economics. Yeah, for example, the report highlights some key concepts like industrial upgrade, research and development incentives, and quality education, increased education spending, something like that. So all they review leaders' anxiety over China's ability to maintain its supply chain security and also create cutting-edge technologies. Yeah, so probably we're going to see more fiscal money being thrown into, for example, development of AI, especially like generative AI, as well as chip making. And probably they are also, I mean, the leaders are also keen to maintain a supply chain that's immune to sanctions or other disruptions.
I'm sure analysts will also be looking for a little bit of guidance on the property market and property policies, not just within China, but also internationally.
The current picture is that the markets remain shaky. So we have the sales in the opening months of this year going down by 40 to 50%, and the construction levels are not very good. And recently we have some other fiscal troubles with some developers. Yeah, so the overall picture is not looking good, but at least according to, based on what we see from the government's reports, there have been little change in policy. So they are still highlighting demand support on city levels, for example, lower mortgage rates, and there's also affordable housing construction and probably more financing support, loans, lending support to property developers. What I think that's what's really needed is a more comprehensive and aggressive bailout package towards all the distressed developers, like what the US government did during the global financial crisis, what they did to the financial institutions. But that's not happening so far, and we have a strong question mark as to whether that will ultimately happen. Yeah, so that's a big question. So property sector will remain a big downside risk for China's economy this year.
And finally, I've only got 30 seconds remaining, Tan Chen, but foreign direct investment, what's the take?
On that topic, the government report largely repeats what it has said in the past 6 to 9 months. I think the signals have been very clear that there's a sort of strong commitments to attracting foreign investment. But the fact is, we haven't seen much progress so far. So I really think that commitment need to be matched by swift actions to really liberalizing the FDI scheme in some selected sectors.
Tian Chen, we're going to leave it there. Thank you so much indeed for your time. Tian Chen Zhu, the senior economist, China for the Economist Intelligence Unit, joining us live from China.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast. You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.